But the trajectory that you put that child on is going to have a huge bearing in where they will end up in life. And today, Hannah was a mother who desperately prayed. In fact, committed that one child to the Lord. And if you look at where her child ended up, becoming one of the greatest leaders in Israel's history. And so before we get into the word here, I want to look at something that I looked at, and just an example of what a legacy does. And when we put our family on a trajectory where that can lead a family years and years down the road. I did a bit of a study, and there was two men that I discovered there were some studies done on their descendants. And the first one was a man named Jonathan Edwards, and they studied approximately 1,400 of his descendants. Now, I know that seems a bit daunting, but there is a, someday, 1,400 people will come from you. And you are currently putting them on a course and a trajectory in life. Jonathan Edwards is kind of a, perhaps a household name here. He had 11 children. He was a preacher, a theologian. He was most famous for a sermon that he preached called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And he also traveled extensively with George Whitefield. During the 1700s, they traveled up and down the 13 colonies doing revival meetings and things of such. And so he was a very, very busy man. He did not have a lot of spare time. But he was known to do two things with his family. Number one, he was known to spend an hour having a one-hour conversation with his family, his wife, his children. He was known to do that. The second thing that he was known for was to pray a blessing over each one of his children. Now, I don't know if he did that every day or not, but 11 children, that would take some time, but he was known to do that periodically. And so those were two things that he was known to do, and those are not really that difficult. It's not difficult to, perhaps today it is more so. We have less and less conversations. Our conversations are more digital now than they used to be, and back then that wasn't possible. This takes place in the middle to late 1700s, and so he did two things. Just an hour conversation, and was known to pray a blessing over each one of his children. So out of the 1,400 descendants of Jonathan Edwards, here's what came out of his generations. There was one U.S. vice president. There was one dean of law school. There was one dean of medical school. There were three U.S. senators, three governors, 13 college presidents, 30 judges, 60 doctors, 65 college professors, 75 military officers, 80 public office holders, 100 lawyers, 100 clergymen, and 285 college graduates. None of his descendants ever cost the state or taxpayers any money. They all contributed. All over just doing two things, having a meaningful conversation and praying a blessing over each one of his children. Now, that's not that difficult to do, but it does require intentionality and it requires time. Now, in that same time period, there was another man that they did studies on, and his name was Max Jukes. During the same time period that Jonathan Edwards would have been raising his family, they studied approximately 1,200 of his descendants. So again, one day 1,200 people will exist because of you. Now, he wasn't necessarily known to be evil or abusive. Some say he might have been an atheist. Others strongly refute that, so we don't know for sure was he an atheist or not. He was known to be a hunter and a fisher. Now, I'm not saying if you're a hunter and a fisher that your family won't turn out well. But he was very uninvolved. He just, he was actually known to have fathered other children out of wedlock. He just really had no vision, no strategy, no plan for his family at all. And just kind of a no-show. He'd rather just go hunt, go fish, and leave me alone. In Dutch, we would have a word for that. I don't know how to say it in English. But in Dutch, we would say, I was grad plein literally. Now, how you want to determine that or how you want to interpret that in English, that's the best word I could come up with. But he was a very, very uninvolved man in the life of his family. He really had no plan or strategy for them at all. Out of his 1,200 descendants, there were 7 murderers, 60 thieves, 190 prostitutes, 150 convicts, 310 paupers. A pauper is someone who basically lives off the system. They lived off of government-assisted programs and things of such. 440 of his descendants were just completely wrecked their lives due to alcohol addiction, and 300 of them died prematurely. They cost the state at that time, the state of New York, $1.2 million, which would equate to about $30 million today. Time spent in prison, government-assisted programs and such. And none of his descendants seemed to contribute much, but rather cost a lot. Now, what a contrast between two families. It's a huge and enormous contrast. One just simply had a plan. He had a godly plan. The other one just didn't do anything. And it's like I've said before, even nothing produces something, but it very seldom produces something that you want or that you like or that you desire. And so one very simple plan, a very godly plan, produced 1,400 people who were contributors, who made something of themselves, and one who didn't have a plan, approximately 1,200 who really accomplished nothing in life and lived a life of reckless abandon, a lot of destruction, addiction, and so forth, and cost the state millions of dollars. I had to think, there's a saying that you are, or your organization, your family, your home, your church, whatever it may be, you are what you allow. What you allow in your home, that's what will become. And so, morals, guidelines, direction are all very important. Personal convictions that you develop are very, very important. And setting guidelines and setting direction, you know, perhaps we've come from places where there was overreach and dominance, and that didn't feel so good either. And sometimes we react to that by just having nothing in place because of the overreach or perhaps the dominance that we experience, and that doesn't work out so well either. But here's a man in Jonathan Edwards who had two very simple things, and it led to generations of being productive, good human beings. I don't know if they were all Christians, I don't know if they were all God-fearing men and women or not, but rather they were very productive in their life. And so, the generations that are going to come from you are a reflection, and they're a direct reflection of your conviction or the lack thereof. And we see this so clearly in these two families that were listed here, and the studies that were done were clearly a reflection of someone's conviction or the lack thereof. Today's message is about a very godly man in the Old Testament whose mother carried a very, very deep burden in her soul. And out of deep anguish and deep conviction of her own soul came forth a very, very godly man. The woman that we're looking at here today, her name is Hannah in 1 Samuel chapter 1. We'll be looking at that chapter extensively here today, but the word Hannah in Hebrew means favored. It means favored one. Now, Hannah finds herself in a place where she probably doesn't feel all that favored at all. And at the time of the anguish of her soul, she certainly does not feel the favor of God. In fact, if anything, perhaps she feels rejected by God. She feels forgotten by God, and she doesn't feel all that favored at all. And I think we would all agree that today we are favored by God. God favors us. He loves us. He cares about us, but we don't always feel all that favored. Sometimes things seem to come against us and things do not work out, and things that we pray for and we seek the Lord after don't seem to always materialize, and they seem to be delayed or perhaps even forgotten. And this is much the story of Hannah, is that she prayed and she then eventually birthed Samuel out of extreme, extreme difficulty in her life. And I want to use this story perhaps as a metaphor or an analogy for our own lives, that we can see that perhaps there are Samuels deeply embedded in our souls that are waiting to be birthed out from us, but it doesn't seem to be happening. And all hope is lost and all hope is gone. So 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1, I want to begin reading here and commentating on the verses here. I have a bit of a cough today, so I'm going to try to preach with a cough drop in my mouth. I have not done that before. So if I get a little overexcited and I swallow this thing and someone knows how to do the Heimlich maneuver, please make your way forward. All right. It says here, now there was a certain man of Ramathaim, Zophim of the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jehoram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. Now it says here that he was an Ephraimite, but he wasn't necessarily a descendant of Ephraim. He lived in the area or the region of Ephraim. And if you look later in the book of Chronicles, we see that Elkanah was actually a Levite. He was from the tribe of Levi, and his descendants, Elkanah's descendants, were actually singers that were appointed in the temple to bring perpetual praise to God once the temple of Solomon had been built. His descendants were some of those singers. Now it says here that he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah. The name of the other, Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now, just a bit of the culture to explain the culture. Perhaps it's pretty obvious, and we're pretty sure that Elkanah's wife, or the first wife that he would have had, was actually Hannah. That was his preferred wife. And because she was barren and could not have any children, Elkanah would have taken a second wife in Peninnah. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right or not. And it was through her that he then had children. But it was clear that it was Hannah that was the one that he had chosen as his wife. Now, I know that's a bit different, and I'm kind of glad in the New Testament that one of the qualifications for a bishop is to have one wife. I think it just works out better that way. There's just less competitiveness, and I have not seen where having multiple wives has worked out that well. And so I'm glad that was changed in the New Covenant. But we see here that in verse, we begin reading on, it says that Elkanah, this man, went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. And whenever the time came for Elkanah to make an offering, he would give portions to Peninnah and his wife and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, although the Lord had closed her womb. So it was clear that Hannah was the preferred one, which that generally is not conducive to healthy marriage relationships if there is more than one wife. And so he gave her a double portion. But we notice here that who closed her womb? Says it was the Lord that closed her womb. And I find this to be a kind of a theme running throughout Scripture, is that women of faith who were promised generations and children often found themselves barren. They couldn't have children. Sarah finds herself barren. I believe Rebecca finds herself barren. Hannah finds herself barren. All great women of faith who were promised or to have many children oftentimes found themselves without the ability to produce or to have children. And so her womb was closed by the Lord. And this is where it can become, we could then conclude that Hannah could actually bear children, but not at this time. She actually had the ability to bear children, but it was the Lord who closed her womb. And it's almost like God put a restriction on her life for that period of time and caused her or did not allow her to be fruitful in this aspect. And sometimes it is the Lord that shuts a door. It's the Lord that closes something in our lives that we don't understand. There's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing, we could conclude that perhaps we don't have enough faith. Perhaps I'm doing something wrong. Perhaps there's something wrong with me. But this very simple thing that God could do, he is restricting me right now. I am not able to do this because it was the Lord that put the restriction there. And in this case, for Hannah, it was the Lord who put the restriction on her. And it's in times and seasons that that we are restricted. And it's very trying where when we're in a season or we're facing something where God is simply just not allowing something to take place in your life. It might be a good thing. It might be something very unselfish. But for whatever reason, the time is not right. And I've seen that one of the very key things to accomplishing kingdom purposes is that timing is everything. And the harder you try, the worse it gets. If the timing is not right, and it's not in the time, and it's not the time for that to take place, you can kick on the door, you can pray, you can fast, you can do whatever you want. If the timing is not right, it will not happen. And in this case, the timing was not for her to have Samuel. And so her womb is closed and nothing is happening. And it's in times like this, whatever it is that you've been restricted from or is not happening in your life, you will notice everyone else that has that very thing that you don't. And that's when it gets really, really tough. Because, Lord, this would be so simple for you. Nothing is too hard for the Lord. Nothing is too difficult for him. How come this is not available for me, but everyone else that's far more evil than I am seems to be enjoying what is being held back and restricted for me? Think about it. For Hannah, there was a deep longing for children. Now that's just natural. And as she looked at her competition or her perhaps adversary, Peninnah, could easily have children. It's not a problem. And it's easy that when you're perhaps in a place like that, it's very easy to take notice of everyone else that can have children, but you can't. And you notice that very quickly. I mean, even stop and think about this generations later, obviously not at this time, but even a wicked King Ahab and a wicked Queen Jezebel could have 70 sons. Now, I don't know if those all came from Jezebel. I don't know if that's even possible. But a wicked man like Ahab could have 70 sons. And what did he ever do right? He did everything that you could have done wrong as a king. He was the most godless, not a man of faith. And yet he could have 70. And here's one faithful woman that's just like, Lord, if I could just have one child, why would you restrict me and restrain me from that? And so we quickly notice what you're praying for that's not happening. Well, it sure shows up in other people that probably aren't even praying for that and maybe not even care about that. Maybe you're single and you'd love to be married, but all your friends, it really seems to be easy for them. And you might even hear them complain about their spouse. Oh, I always have to pick up after him, and she does this and she does that. And you're thinking, I would love to just have that problem. I'd love to just be able to complain about my spouse because I don't even have one to complain about. We shouldn't complain about our spouses, but it's in times like that that we hear things like that and we become very sensitive to them. And it's like, why is that happening for everyone else but not me? And surely the Lord knows the longing of my heart. Maybe it's a dream career of some kind, and others can so easily find the passion they love, and there's just job openings and opportunities. There's business opportunities, and doors just open, and wow, they just walk in, and all the clients seem to go to them. And Lord, if I just have one opportunity, I'd take it. But Lord, I'm not even finding an open door. I'm stuck. There's no opportunities for me. And Lord, why is this one thing that I so desperately long for, and yet it seems like you're withholding it from me? And you're sensitive to that because you notice everybody that has an opportunity. You notice them, but it's not happening for you. And so we become very sensitive. Or just simple things like friends. You know, Lord, if I could just have one friend, and yet there's some people that have so many, they don't know what to do with all their friends. And people seem to just gravitate towards that person, and they don't seem to gravitate towards me. And is it too much to ask of God? Just a few friends. That's all I'm asking for. And yet it seems to elude you. I've had many of these conundrums in my life as well. And I remember one of the big things that I had prayed for is, God, early in ministry, I said, God, if I just had one other pastor, just one other minister, oh, I would give the world, I'd do anything to just have one other minister. And that one thing that I desired, and I was like, Lord, it's not a selfish desire, is it? I mean, Lord, I don't even have to be the lead pastor. I don't even have to be important. I don't care. I just want one other minister. And that one thing that I prayed for and I sought after just never happened. It just never happened. And I would go to other churches and watch them have ordinations. And oh, it was so simple. The lead pastor was retiring so they could ordain a bishop. And it was so not hard. And then they had to ordain a couple other young ones. And they just did it. And finally, I quit going to ordinations. I couldn't stand it anymore. It's like, I'm done going. Seems so easy for other churches, but boy, that one pastor, in 10 years, never ordained another minister. And I just could not figure out, what have I done wrong? Why is it so easy for other churches? But boy, our church, it was not happening. And it didn't seem like it was ever going to happen. And so whatever it is that you're not finding, you will always notice when other people have it. And if we're not careful, we can become very bitter and resentful towards others who seemingly are finding everything that you're looking for, but you can't find it. Now, as the story goes on, it says here in verse 6, and her rival, so this other wife, the Bible calls her rival, also provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her womb. So it was year by year when she went up to the house of the Lord that she provoked her. Therefore, she wept and she did not eat. Now, not only could she not have children, but the one that could have children very easily, and it was never a problem, now began to taunt her, began to make fun of her, began to just make life very, very, very miserable for Hannah. And perhaps she, I can only imagine the pain of your own soul, of going through not being able to have children. Now someone else is even making fun of me. Now someone else is rubbing, like rubbing salt into an open wound. And boy, that hurt, especially coming from the same household. And I imagine she was a human being like all of us are, and that's caused a lot of pain and a lot of discomfort in her life. And Peninnah made sure that Hannah stayed miserable. She made sure that Hannah understood that I am fruitful and you're not. I am able to provide descendants for my husband and you are not. You're the one that's barren. You're the loser. You're the one that can't produce. You're the one that is causing grief, perhaps, for Elkanah. And even Sarah, I think, went through this kind of the same trauma herself. She realized she's the one that cannot bring children for Abraham. And but one thing that I saw here is that Peninnah was using this opportunity to really cast Hannah down and bring her a lot of pain and affliction in her life. And she did it by taunting and making fun of her. One thing, I just want to stop here and say this. I have never in my life, I've seen this play out almost always. I've never seen a case where someone, when they made fun of someone else, that very thing didn't come back to haunt them one day. And I have a really good memory. I can still remember in school, before we had anti-bullying laws, that there was a lot of fun made of other students, and that was just kind of a common thing back then. I can remember, I guess one thing that I have is a very good memory. I never took notes in school. I still don't take notes today. I'll go to a conference and never write a thing down, and I see people with pages full of stuff, and I'm like, how can you remember what the guy said? Because you're writing stuff down. Whenever I go to Israel, I always have these note takers, and I kind of laugh at them because I kid you not, a month later, those very note takers call me and say, hey, can you remember, you know, what we talked about up on this mountain? I'm like, yeah, I remember. But you don't, because you were taking notes. You missed half the presentation. So I have a really good memory, and I can remember a lot of those very students that made fun of others in school. And almost every last one of those, I know what they did and I know what they said. And for many of them, it came back and it found them as well. That's just one thing. We don't even have to use words to make fun of someone else. It can just be an expression. It can be a sneer. It can just be a snide little remark. Believe me, those very things, those expressions, those words, they will always come back and they'll haunt people that do that. And perhaps Peninnah felt less because she was not the favored one. Perhaps she felt she wasn't as loved. Elkanah obviously had chosen Hannah first as his wife, and perhaps she felt that she was less than Hannah and used this opportunity to really elevate herself and make herself feel important. See, sometimes in life, it kind of feels good if someone else suffers, because then it makes me feel good about my situation. And a lot of people are waiting for their own peace of their own souls until someone else suffers, and then I'll feel good about myself. And yet, when we do that, it always comes back and it finds us. And in this case, Peninnah, I don't know what she kind of vanishes off the scene here. After Samuel's born, we don't hear about her at all. And however, day after day, Hannah must have been tormented in her soul because of what her own lack and because of what was being inflicted on her in from her, it says here, her own rival. And there's nothing more difficult when you're being harassed like that and you can't do anything about it. You can't do anything to change your situation. And here she is, barren, unable, and she is being taunted by her rival. Then in verse 8 it says, "Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her." I often wonder where Elkanah was in this. Shouldn't he have stepped in a bit and said, "Hey, this is not healthy. This isn't right. This shouldn't be happening." But nevertheless, it says here in verse 8 that Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? Why is your heart grieved?" He saw the sadness. He saw her countenance, how it had fallen. And he said, "Am I not better to you? Am I not better to you than even 10 sons? Am I not enough? Am I not sufficient for you? And am I not more than 7 sons?" And it's in the midst of what you are longing for that's not taking place that God asks, "Am I not enough? Am I not everything that you need anyway? If this never happens and this never comes to pass in your life, am I not enough?" And like Pastor Wayne last Sunday, he preached that his grace is sufficient. His grace is sufficient for us. And after this, after Elkanah spoke these words to her, perhaps she changed her mind a bit, because we see here that in verse 9 it says, "And so Hannah rose after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat of the doorpost of the tabernacle of the Lord. And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish." And then it says, "Then she made a vow and said, 'O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come on his head.'" She said, "God, if you give me a son, if you give me a child, if you don't forget your maidservant, if you don't forget me," because by now, I'm sure Hannah felt that God has completely forgotten me. He has completely abandoned me. Where is he when all the taunting starts? Where is he? And where is he in the longings of my own heart? And she said, "God, if you don't forget me and you give me one male child, you give me a son, I will give him back to you. I'll give him completely back to you." In fact, she said that no razor will touch his head. Now, she took on a Nazirite vow for Samuel. If you look in the Old Testament, one of the things that Moses instructed the people, he said that if you want to completely separate yourself to the Lord, then you need to take upon yourself a Nazirite vow. And within that vow, there were certain conditions. We know Samson had a Nazirite vow taken on his life. They were not to drink any wine. They were to stay away from dead. Basically, if you have a Nazirite vow, you're not going to a viewing. You're not going to a funeral, because you cannot come in close contact with a dead body. And also, you cannot shave or cut your hair. And so one of the things that she said here is, "God, I'm willing to completely and totally separate him to the Lord, and I'm even willing to take on a vow on his behalf. No razor will touch his head, and I will give him back to you." Now, it also seems that this fits the theme we see in the Bible of mothers who had to give up their children, especially ones who were promised to them, ones that they bore out of faith that they could not produce naturally. If you look at Sarah, she had to give up Isaac and allow Abraham to take him up onto a mountain and there sacrifice him. Obviously, we know the story. God provided another sacrifice, but in her heart, she had to give him up. The one son that God had given her, she now had to give up, and she had to surrender. If you look at Jochebed, the mother of Moses, she gave up Moses, and she gave him, really, it's quite a story if you think about it. She gave him over to the Egyptian lifestyle, Egyptian culture. And perhaps she would see him at a distance. We don't know for sure, but perhaps she saw him. She knew that now he is being raised by the Egyptians and not me. And she's now out of my care. And there's nothing that is, there's no deeper connection than a mother with its child. And obviously Hannah with Samuel, and also the mother Mary, she gave up her son Jesus. And you see this theme throughout the Bible, women of faith giving up their children. And now she's willing to separate him to the Lord. And if you look, her son did become a very, very great man of God and led Israel through some of the worst, very, very times of great trouble and turmoil, and turned the hearts of Israel back to God. And we see here that it was this separation even from birth. Even from the very time that she gave birth to him, this separation unto the Lord is what made Samuel to be so mightily used by God. And I've never seen a case where a person who was mightily used by God was not also separated in some way, shape, or form. If we want to be used by God, we have to be separated unto the Lord. You simply cannot be used in a great and mighty way if you're not separated in some way, some shape, or form. And I'm not saying that we have to take on ourselves some kind of a Nazirite vow or anything else or anything like that. But what is it that separates you unto the Lord? If we would go up and down these aisles and I would ask you, what do you do or don't do or whatever it may be, what do? That separates you from the Lord? What do that perhaps no one else does? It doesn't have to be a Nazirite vow, and it's not out of some religious duty that we have to do to the Lord. But if we're going to be used mightily by God, then there is something that has to separate, something that we have to do, or something that separates us, that shows the Lord that I am completely separated unto you. And this was the case of Samuel. And so in verses, we read on, it says here that in verse 12, and it happened as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli watched her mouth. Now Hannah spoke in her heart, only her lips moved. So she wasn't audibly speaking. It was only in her spirit, her lips were moving. But her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli thought she was drunk. So Eli said to her, "How long will you be drunk? Put away your wine from you." But Hannah answered and said, "No, my lord, I am a woman of sorrow, of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant a wicked woman, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken until now." And so we see that in her state of anguish and the intensity of her own soul, that she actually appears drunk. She appears to be out of her mind. She appears to be out of control. And so Eli reprimands her and says to her to put away her drink. But she is in such deep anguish, and she is in such deep, in a deep sense of prayer, that she was willing. She didn't care who saw her. She didn't care what she looked like. She was in such a desperate time of her life. And so we see here that Eli answered and said to her, "Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition which you have asked of him." And she said, "Let your maidservant find favor in your sight." So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. Then they rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord, and returned and came to their house in Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So it came to pass in the process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son, and called his name Samuel, saying, "Because I have asked for him from the Lord." Now, so the Lord does hear her. He does answer her prayer, and she names him Samuel, which means God hears. The word Sam comes from a root word of Shema in the Hebrew. When they would actually recite Shema, which means to hear, Shema Israel, and they would recite the Shema. It actually means here, and the word El at the end of his name, which is a portion of the word Elohim, means God hears. But this is no ordinary child. This is no ordinary son that she has. She has a Samuel. She has a child who goes on and leads Israel in a time of great turmoil. In fact, he anoints the first king of Israel in Saul, and then he also anoints David, perhaps one of the greatest kings of all time in Israel's history, and he becomes a very, very influential man of God. So he's not an ordinary child. He's not an ordinary son. He's one that's been separated already from birth. He's already been separated unto the Lord. And it's because of a faithful mother's prayer, and it's because of her deep longing in her heart and her passion and her soul that she is able to overcome the bitterness that's being projected against her from her rival, Peninnah. And she's able to look to the Lord, and she's able to cry out in faith. And so she births Samuel out of a very deep, deep affliction of her soul, and it really is a miracle because up until now, her womb has been closed. She is not able to have children. And so this is a promise that's been brought forth out of a miracle. But if you look at the timing of everything, the timing of the birth of Samuel is absolutely perfect. It's in the very perfect time that Samuel is born. Because if he's born too early, Israel's not ready for him. If he's born any later, it would have been too late. Samuel comes exactly at the moment and time that Israel needs him. Samuel comes at a time when God is now ready for Samuel. And boy, it was worth the wait, wasn't it? Now, unlike Peninnah's children, I don't want to downgrade them, but we don't really hear of them at all. From this point on, we don't really hear whatever happened to her children, because they weren't birthed out of deep affliction of soul. In fact, they were birthed out of taunting, out of making fun of someone else. They were born naturally. They weren't born out of faith. And we don't really hear much of her descendants at all. But things that are birthed out of faith, only God can do, and only in his time. Timing is everything. And timing, and in God's timing, it is always perfect. His timing is always on time, and it's never too early, it's never too late. It was that way for Samuel. It was that way for me. And it's that way for you. God's timing is absolutely perfect. And so here comes a Samuel on the scene, and he really changes, and he really turns the course of history. And he was an influential son because he was born out of faith and out of a deep affliction of his own, of his mother's soul. And so, the very deep longings that we have in our heart, the very deep things that God puts there, can only come forth out of God's perfect will and God's perfect timing. It will not be up to you. If you can do it and if you can make it happen, it probably is not faith and it doesn't require any faith. Now, the metaphor that I want to see here and that a picture that I believe the Word of God is painting for us here is a picture, or it's a metaphor of perhaps a Samuel that's in you. Now, I'm not talking a literal Samuel. I'm talking about a spiritual Samuel. A spiritual longing, something that's deep in your heart and something that is deep in your soul, a deep anguish over something that perhaps seems to be eluding you right now. You've prayed for it. You've fasted for it. You've sought. You've knocked. You've done everything. Those are always the Samuels. And in the same way that perhaps a mother carries a child, so in the same way you and I carry the deep spiritual things of God. And then we birth them into the earth. We birth them forth, but it usually comes out of a deep anguish of the soul. And so these deep yearnings, these longings, these spiritual passions, the perhaps an anguish over a situation, an anguish over a child, over a lost someone, whoever that may be, whatever it may be, these become burdens that we carry with us. And we carry with us. And when these things are birthed forth, they become Samuels. They become things of great influence. And they can only come forth when the time is right. Divine timing. And so how do these deep, deep things end up in our spiritual womb? I'm not talking about a physical one. I'm talking about men, women, everyone in here. You have the capacity to carry the things of heaven. You really do. And God puts them there so that out of the anguish of our soul, we birth them forth. Now, I want to look at, just in conclusion here, I want to look at a verse in Hebrews chapter 11. In fact, I want to conclude with this verse. In fact, I think I might have 5-10 minutes to go if the worship team wants to make their way up here. They may do so. But Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, we have heard this verse many, many times because I want us to understand that what's deep inside of you wasn't necessarily even put there by you. It says here, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." We've heard this verse many, many times. But what we see here is that faith has substance. Now, we often think of faith as something that I can't see. And that's true, but it does have substance or it couldn't be faith. So it has something. Substance simply means in order for something to exist, it has to have matter. It has to have something to it or it wouldn't be something. You have substance. I can see you. You're made of flesh and bone and skin and all that. I can see the substance of what makes you. Well, faith has the same thing. It has substance. Now, what is the substance? Well, the Word of God says here that the substance is of things hoped for. So things that you hope for is the substance of faith. Now, this isn't necessarily a hope called like wishful thinking of such. Like, I hope it doesn't rain tomorrow, or I hope my favorite sports team wins the championship. It's that we're not talking about that kind of hope. That's wishful thinking. And so the deep longings of your heart that simply don't go away, the things that nag at your soul, the quest, that's hope, and that's in you. Now the question is, who put that there? How did that hope, how did that longing ever get there? It wasn't you that put it there. It was God that put it there. In fact, I like to say heaven put it there. The entire Godhead and everything that makes God, God, all of heaven put that there. So that's things hoped for, things that God put in your soul is the substance of what makes faith. And so you didn't even put it there. God put it there. Heaven put it there. But now you carry that. And sometimes it doesn't seem like anything is really happening with that. Well, God, you put it there. You put it there. So why is nothing happening? Now, it also says here that this substance of things hoped for is the evidence of things not seen. So you can take what is in you, what you have hoped for, what you've longed for, what's in your heart that's been put there by heaven, you can take that as evidence or proof that what's there will actually come to pass. It's actually an assurance. It's a done deal. In fact, you are not able, or you're not going to be able to bring it forth. Only God will bring it forth when the time is absolutely right. And it's almost like, I like to look at it this way, it's like we've been impregnated with heavenly seed that the Father puts there, not even us, that He puts there. And so He asks us to carry that, and it becomes a burden. It does. The same way that a mother carries a child in her womb, that becomes a burden. Believe me, I've had 4 of them after 9 months of carrying that child. It's time to bring it forth. And I think I speak on behalf of all mothers here. It's time to bring it forth. And we sense that pressure in our souls. God, you put it there. There's anguish in my soul. It's time for this to bring forth. It's time to bring it forth. But only God will when the time is perfectly right. And so faith has substance. It has some matter to it. And it's things hoped for. And the things that you hope for and that you long for are actually put there by God. And you can be assured by the evidence. The fact that it's there is clear evidence that it will come forth. It's almost like God giving you a bit of a forewarning of what will come from you, what will come forth, what will come. And so, I think Hannah, in much the same way, must have sensed that something great and something really influential will take place through me. And that was the most difficult one to bear, was the Samuel. Now, we do know that Hannah had other children. She had daughters and sons, and I forget how many. That's later on in the chapter somewhere that she had. But it was that one Samuel that she bore out of deep pain and anguish that became the one that God used the most. And so, looking back over my life, I can really honestly stand before you and say that everything I ever hoped for, not wishful thinking, there were a few wishful things that actually went my way. They actually did, but I'm not talking about those things. I'm talking about the deep things that heaven puts there. I can honestly say that every one of those, it came forth. It did, but never the way I thought. And never did it come without some deep, deep, deep anguish of the soul. In fact, it will always become hopeless before it becomes hopeful. Otherwise, it's not a Samuel. It's just something you can do. And we can all do great things, but none of us can produce a Samuel. And so, there's a Samuel inside all of you. Perhaps right now you're praying for something, you're longing for something, you've been knocking on heaven's door, and it doesn't seem to be happening, but the fact that it's there, it has substance, and God put it there, and in fact, you don't even have to worry about bringing it forth. He will. When the time is right, He is the one that will bring it forth. And so I just ask you to take courage. Because what you hope for comes from God, and it comes from heaven, and you can be assured that it will bring forth. And so just as a kind of like a P.S., the very thing I long for, well, I got it. I always long for just one other minister, and now I got four of them. Now, I don't own them or anything like that, but God granted that one. And I was pretty sure that one would never happen. I kind of came to a place where I said, well, I guess that's the one thing that will probably just never, I'll always wonder. I'll probably always wonder, Lord, why was that one so difficult for you to answer? But he did. But it didn't come without tremendous, tremendous anguish of soul. It didn't come easy. It was very, very, very difficult. And if I look back, it was nothing that I did. It was what he brought forth. It's what he did. And so right now, this very minute, I have things that I am hoping for that haven't happened yet. But looking at the past and what God has done, I already know what he will do. And so you can take courage and you can step forward in knowing that what God has put in your soul and what he's put in your spiritual womb, that's evidence that God will bring it forth. He will. And so take courage and rise up and walk in confidence because he's the one. He's the one that will bring it forth. You carry something very deep and very precious in your soul. You all do. We all have those longings of something spiritual and something very deep that we desire. but you can be assured he's the one. He's the one that will carry you through. All he asks of us is to bear that burden right now and just carry it and be faithful. If Hannah would have lashed out against her rival and would have become very vexed and bitter at her, perhaps that would have not taken place. Perhaps Samuel would not have come. But it's even when we're bearing that burden, and perhaps there's a Peninnah in your life that's just taunting you, provoking you, making life very, very difficult. Just remember the one who put the promise in you. Just remember, he's the one that will carry you through. So God bless you and stay encouraged. Thank you.